That was a special presentation, an encore presentation of Backstage Stories here on WBAI. It's just about 10 o'clock here in New York City. Usually at the 9 o'clock hour, you would hear Dream Leapers with Harriet Cole. Harriet is off this week and will be back next week with a brand new edition of Dream Leapers. Thank you all so much for tuning in. And we have some additional programming coming your way, an encore presentation that is up next. So please stay tuned. This is WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM. Listener sponsored and commercially free.
Welcome now to this edition of the program Talk Back here on listener-sponsored commercial-free radio, WBAI New York, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming live on the web at WBAI.org. I am Hugh Hamilton. The audio engineer is Mr. Michael G. Haskins, who is also our director of incidental music. And I want to begin the program by spending some time reflecting on a story, the enormity of which, to my mind, is yet to be sufficiently explored in much of the corporate and mainstream media. Now, the story itself has been widely reported, but the history and context within which its meaning is to be situated and analyzed have not yet been given their fair share of attention. The story to which I refer is the 2-year Guatemala syphilis study conducted by U.S. public health doctors from 1946 to 1948. And I have deliberately held my tongue on this for the past week or nearly the past week, just to see where the coverage is going on this story and the amount of play that the story is going to get. In fact, one of the things I had hoped would happen, because even here on the so-called left, even here we have not paid enough attention to that story. and the significance of that story and the enormity of what took place there, and this is enormity in its correct sense, the enormity of what took place in the course of that 2-year study from 1946 to 1948. So we're going to spend some time at the beginning of the program reflecting on that story and then situating it within its appropriate or proper historical context. Now, as the New York Times reported, the person who did the reporting was Donald McNeil, and I do have to say that the New York Times, to its credit, gave Donald McNeil wrote a pretty good story here in which he touched on many of the relevant and salient facts and factors that ought to be considered in discussing the story. But the Times, I think, let the ball drop in failing to follow up on this story and to have, particularly in its weekend edition, weekend review section, to have as expansive a discussion of its meaning as I believe the circumstances merit. Now, as McNeil reported in the New York Times in his story dated October 1st, from 1946 to 1948, American public health doctors deliberately infected nearly 700 Guatemalans, prison inmates, mental patients, and soldiers with venereal diseases in what was meant as an effort to test the effectiveness of penicillin. Now, let me pause here for a moment to say this. I have seen varying numbers on the on this, the number of individuals who were subjected to these studies. One report that I saw last Friday from CNN put the number of those who were deliberately infected at more than 1,600 people. I see that we've sort of settled into this 700 range now, and everybody is using this 700. But that initial report from CNN on Friday had said, and I quote, "The tests were carried out on female commercial sex workers, prisoners in the National Penitentiary, patients in the National Mental Hospital, and soldiers. According to the study, more than 1,600 people were infected, 696 of them with syphilis, 772 of them with gonorrhea, and another 142 with another venereal disease, another STD. So, I mentioned that to say that this discrepancy in the figures is yet to be resolved to my satisfaction. But if we're working with the 700 figure, let's continue to do so for the time being just as a working number, but you need to keep that more than 1,600 figure from CNN in the back of your mind. Now, American tax dollars through the National Institutes of Health even paid for syphilis-infected prostitutes to sleep with prisoners since Guatemalan prisons allowed such visits. And here's you want to cover your children's ears on this part. When the prostitutes did not succeed in infecting the men, some prisoners had the bacteria poured into scrapes made on their penises, faces, or arms, and in some cases it was injected by spinal puncture. If the subjects contracted the disease, they were then given antibiotics. Now, I'm not going to go into any any additional detail regarding these scripts and the pouring of the bacteria into the resultant abrasions or openings. I'm not going to get into that, but you can let your mind take care of fill in the blank. Thanks. Dr. Susan M. Reverby, who was the professor, she's a professor at Wellesley College, who brought the experiments to light in a research paper that prompted American health officials to investigate. She points out that whether anyone was actually cured was not clear. Remember, if the subjects contracted the disease, they were then given antibiotics. But based on her research, whether anyone was then cured is not clear. The revelations were made public when Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius apologized to the government of Guatemala and the survivors and descendants of those infected. They called the experiments clearly unethical, which I think is not a bad place to start, clearly unethical, but there's an understatement. If if you're looking for one. Now, their statement went on to say, although these events occurred more than 64 years ago, we are outraged that such reprehensible research could have occurred under the guise of public health. We deeply regret, the secretaries wrote, we deeply regret that it happened, and we apologize to all the individuals who were infected by such abhorrent research practices. And in a twist to the revelation, the public health doctor who led that experiment in Guatemala, Dr. John C. Cutler, would later have an important role in the Tuskegee study, in which black American men with syphilis were deliberately left untreated for decades. His unpublished Guatemala work, Dr. Cutler's unpublished Guatemala work, was unearthed recently in the archives of the University of Pittsburgh by Professor Everby, a medical historian who has written two books about Tuskegee. And that Tuskegee study now, it provides us with context number one. Remember I said that the discussion of this story, to the extent that there has been any, has failed properly to situate the story within the context within the appropriate history and context, so that its meaning and implications can be properly analyzed. So the Tuskegee link, Dr. John Cutler, who led the Guatemala, the abhorrent Guatemala research experimentation, and who subsequently went on to have a leading role in the Tuskegee study, in which black American men with syphilis were deliberately left untreated for decades, that provides us with context number one, which is the issue of race. Now, for those who are not familiar with the Tuskegee experiment, and I have to keep reminding myself that there are people who were born in the last 20 years and who have not been given the benefit of this education in our public school or even in our private school systems. There are people who have immigrated to this country in the past 20, 30 years who have not made it their business to find out about this aspect of American history and who have not been introduced to this history by others. So there is a substantial segment of the American population that is, I wouldn't go so far as to say blissfully ignorant, but I would say that is ignorant, often through no fault of their own, of these unsavory aspects of American history. Let me say this. There was a 1993 film, a documentary made by Nova on this. It won the 1993 National Association of Black Journalists Award. The documentary is called The Deadly Deception. I can tell you this. That documentary has pretty much disappeared from view. Those people who have that documentary now are sitting on the equivalent of gold, because this is history that has been deliberately suppressed over the years. Anyway, we're not going to digress. I'm saying that by way of very quick background, for those who are not familiar with the Tuskegee experiment, the United States Public Health Service, remember, we're dealing here with the federal government, okay? We're dealing with the federal government here. The same federal government that was behind this Guatemala experiment, which came to light last Friday. The United States Public Health Service's Tuskegee study of untreated syphilis in the Negro male represents an infamous chapter in the annals of American medical research. Starting in 1932, 399 indigent Southern black men were recruited by health researchers who led them to believe that they would receive free medical treatment for what the medical professionals at the time recalled bad blood. And these men were carefully monitored as the disease being syphilis, claimed its victims. The men were not told that they had syphilis, which can cause a variety of health complications and problems, including mental illness, blindness, tumors, and eventually death. And these men, many of whom were sharecroppers, we remember this started in 1932. Okay, many of these men were illiterate, meaning they could not read and write because they had never been given the opportunity to learn how to read and write. Remember, we're talking here about a period in American history that is right after what has come to be known as the nadir of race relations in this country that began around 1890 and continued well into the 1920s. This was the time when Southern white racists were running rampant with their lynchings, and blacks were being subjected to Jim Crow was at its height. You had the black codes. I mean, you're talking here about a state of de facto apartheid that had come to, that had taken root in the United States. This would continue until, of course, the 1960s and the civil rights movement. So this is the time period we're dealing with. Now, these men, these black men, African-American men, most of whom were, could not read and write, they were sharecroppers, they were poor, they were variously described as indigent, were not told that they had syphilis, which can cause mental illness and death. They were never treated for the disease, even after penicillin was found to be a successful cure in the mid-1940s. That treatment was withheld from them. Tuskegee, which is a historically black college in Alabama, did not participate in the syphilis study. The program was ended only when it was publicly exposed in 1972. So this is a 40-year study that was that only ended well into the lifetimes of many of you who are listening right now. In my own lifetime, this started well before my lifetime began and continued into my lifetime. So this ended was publicly exposed only in 1972, and only then were its survivors treated for syphilis. Now, President Bill Clinton issued a formal apology for this notorious research study at Tuskegee on May 16th of 1997, in the course of which he uttered the now famous line, and I quote, "To our African-American citizens, I am sorry that your federal government orchestrated a study so clearly racist," unquote. Now, there are many people who don't know that President Clinton actually used that term, racist, and actually uttered those words, because this was not just an apology that was issued on paper. This was an apology that he spoke at a formal ceremony, and he used those words. So when I say that context number one is race, I'm not making this stuff up. The President of the United States formally acknowledged that race was a critical element in the context of the Tuskegee experiment when he said, quote, "To our African-American citizens, I am sorry that your federal government orchestrated a study so clearly racist." Now, back to the Guatemala study. Professor Everby presented her findings about the Guatemalan experiments at a conference in January, but nobody took notice. Then in June, she sent a draft of an article that she was preparing for the January 2011 issue of the Journal of Policy History to Dr. David J. Censer, who is a former director of the Centers for Disease Control, and it was he who prodded the government to investigate. In the 1940s, Professor Everby explained to the New York Times, "The United States Public Health Service was, quote, deeply interested in whether penicillin could be used to prevent, not just cure, early syphilis infection, whether better blood tests for the disease could be established and dosages of penicillin actually cured infection, and to understand the process of reinfection after cures. It had difficulties growing syphilis in the laboratory." Okay, this is, we're talking here about the U.S. United States Public Health Service. "In the course of this research, the U.S. Public Health Service encountered difficulties growing syphilis in the laboratory, and its tests on rabbits and chimpanzees told it little about how penicillin worked in humans. In 1944, it injected prison volunteers." These are volunteers in quotes, because as has been pointed out before, when you're in prison, the question of whether you have the capacity to volunteer, I mean, somebody who, if you have the capacity to volunteer if you're in prison, is itself debatable. Okay. But these so-called volunteers, they injected prison volunteers at the Terre Haute Federal Penitentiary in Indiana in 1944 with lab-grown gonorrhea, but found it hard to infect people that way. Then in 1946, Dr. Cutler, he have subsequently to become famous for the Tuskegee experiment. In 1946, Dr. Cutler was asked to lead the Guatemala mission, which ended 2 years later, partly because of medical gossip about the work. Dr. Cutler would later join the study in Tuskegee. In 1972, it was revealed, as we mentioned, that even when early antibiotics were invented, doctors hid that fact from the men at Tuskegee in order to keep studying them. And as Donald McNeil reports for the Times, deception was also used in Guatemala. Dr. Thomas Paran, the former Surgeon General who oversaw the start of Tuskegee, acknowledged that the Guatemala work could not be done domestically, and details were hidden from Guatemalan officials, which brings us now to context number two, what I call crimes of conscience. Note, Dr. Thomas Paran, the former Surgeon General who oversaw the start of Tuskegee, acknowledged that the Guatemala work could not be done domestically. In other words, you could not get away with that sort of thing in the United States. Okay? Now, we know that the Tuskegee experiment, of course, had begun in 1932 and had been under wraps and so on. But, and they were doing this without the knowledge and had gone to extreme lengths in order to practice all kinds of deceptive, to put in place deceptive procedures and practices in order to withhold that research from the public and indeed from the people who by then had become subjects. So Dr. Parent says that the Guatemala work could not be done domestically and details were hidden from Guatemalan officials, which brings us, as I said, to context number two, which I refer to as crimes of conscience. Why do I say crimes of conscience? Now, Dr. Mark Siegler, S-I-E-G-L-E-R, who is director of the McLean Center for Clinical Medical Ethics at the University of Chicago's Medical School, said when he heard about this Guatemala study that he was stunned. He described it as shocking and, in fact, went so far as to say this is much worse than Tuskegee. At least those men were infected by natural means. Now, I'm not going to get sidetracked on that one on the question of which was worse. The having men who were infected by natural means go untreated even after treatments had been discovered and become available in order to observe the progress of the disease in these men, knowing what terrible and painful and debilitating consequences would follow from a failure to treat these men even after treatment had become available. But then Dr. Siegler went on to say, it is ironic. No, it's worse than that. It's appalling, he said, that at the same time as the United States was prosecuting Nazi doctors for crimes against humanity, the U.S. government was supporting research that placed human subjects at enormous risk, this in Guatemala. This is why I say now, I said crimes of conscience. Dr. Siegler uses the term crimes against humanity. I refrained from using the term crimes against humanity for the following technical reason, that it was not until 1964, in the 1964 Helsinki Declaration, that medical associations from around the world adopted a code of ethics outlawing certain atrocities that had of the kind that had been practiced by the Nazi doctors and exposed at Nuremberg. And even then, that did not quite have the force of law. But it wasn't until 1964 in the Helsinki Declaration that this became something on which medical associations around the world had adopted a common public position. And then it was not until 1981 that the Tuskegee scandal and the subsequent hearings that were conducted by Senator Edward Kennedy became the basis for the 1981 American laws governing research on human subjects. So one can conceivably try to argue that at the time that these experiments were taking place, they were not technically crimes against humanity. But that is an argument, and it is an argument to which there is a convincing rebuttal in view of the fact that, as Dr. Siegler pointed out, the Nazi doctors were being prosecuted for crimes against humanity by the United States. So we were, on the one hand, prosecuting the Nazi doctors for crimes against humanity at the same time that we were perpetrating this outrage, this atrocity in Guatemala. Now, these two contexts, race and crimes of conscience, or some might say crimes against humanity, but race and crimes of conscience, these are the two elements that I wanted to put on the table here this afternoon as we frame our discussion of this, of medical research and medical experimentation and the recent, the news about the syphilis tests in Guatemala and their inevitable link and their link, to the Tuskegee experiments. And that now leads me to the following offer. Harriet Washington has been a fellow in ethics at Harvard Medical School, as well as a fellow at the Harvard School of Public Health and a senior research scholar at the National Center for Bioethics at Tuskegee University. She is also a journalist and an editor and has worked for USA Today and several other publications. She's been a Knight Fellow at Stanford University and has written for such academic forums as the Harvard Public Health Review and the New England Journal of Medicine. She is also the recipient of numerous prestigious awards for her work. And she is perhaps now most famously author of the seminal book, Medical Apartheid, The Dark History of Medical Experimentation on Black Americans from Colonial Times to the Present. This is a 500-page book, but you would not believe that it is 500 pages once you start to read it, because you'll be zipping through this book at a pretty fast rate of speed, because the writing is very compelling. The subject is also very compelling. So Harriet Washington wrote this book called Medical Apartheid, or Medical Apartheid. I'm told that the correct pronunciation is apartheid, A-P-A-R-T-H-E-I-D, but I know many people commonly say apartheid. So the book is Medical Apartheid, or Medical Apartheid, The Dark History of Medical Experimentation on Black Americans from Colonial Times to the Present. I want you to get this book. We are going to make it available to you this afternoon, together with a 70-minute interview, an interview running more than an hour, an interview with the author Harriet Washington, an interview conducted by WBAI's Kathy Davis. We will send you both the book and the interview with Harriet Washington and Kathy Davis. We'll send you them both as a thank you gift when you make us a pledge of support to WBAI at the $125 level. So that's a $125 pledge to this radio station, to WBAI, a pledge in support of Talkback, a pledge in support of what it is that we do. The fact that I just spent the last half hour, which is more time than any other radio station anywhere has spent, and I say this without fear of successful contradiction. You cannot show me another radio. You cannot tell me of another radio station or point to anywhere in the corporate mainstream media where they have invested half an hour of prime time, or any other prime time, whether it's morning or afternoon, in a discussion of this issue of the sort that I just presented here, and a framing of the issue, outlining the matter in the way that we have just done. This is what we do here on Talkback. You know, I sometimes say that anybody can tell you what the news is, but here we tell you what it means. There's what the news is and there's what the news means. Now, here on Talkback, Monday through Thursday, 3 to 5 in the afternoon, we see this as a forum that is dedicated to the free and fair exchange of information and ideas. It is a program, as you know, that we say is dedicated to the advancement of the public understanding. And we'd like to be able to continue to do the work that we're doing, and your support is indispensable to that effort. So we'd like you now to make a pledge of support. Now, here's the number to call, 212-209-2950. I'm sorry. That's 212-209-2950. Let me say it again, 212-209-2950. This afternoon, we'd like to send you a gift of Harriet Washington's award-winning seminal book, Medical Apartheid, The Dark History of Medical Experimentation on Black Americans from Colonial Times to the Present. It's a 500-page book, and it comes together with a 70-minute interview. Harriet Washington came into our studios here and was interviewed. We spoke with WBAI's Kathy Davis. The interview is 70 minutes long. You get them both with your pledge at the $125 level. And here's the thing. Because this is an issue of such compelling importance, and because this is such a topical issue, and it is an issue that is going to inform so much of our public conversation in for the foreseeable future in view of these recent revelations about this notorious Guatemala medical experimentation, for students and others who are on fixed income, I do not want you to be left out. So if you can't make us a pledge at the $125 level, we will send you the interview with Harriet Washington with your pledge at the $35 level. How is that? So you can get the interview on audio CD. It's a 70-minute interview. Author Harriet Washington in conversation with WBAI's Kathy Davis, in the course of which, by the way, they cover matters ranging from slavery and experimentation and display of enslaved Africans, the Tuskegee experiment and eugenics. They talk about biotechnology and bioterrorism. Harriet Washington discusses the military and the prisons in the context of medical apartheid, the current state of experiments and access and research, and so on. So this is available. In fact, I'm going to share with you in another 2 minutes or so. We'll hit track two. Cut two. I'm going to share with you. Thank you very much to those who are on the line right now. In another 2 minutes or so, I'd like to begin sharing with you an excerpt from Kathy Davis' really a very, very informative interview with author Harriet Washington. Let's get 10 additional calls on the board. Can we get 10 more calls on the board right now? You and 9 other people. 212-209-2950 is the number. That's 212-209-2950. I need 10 additional calls. 212-209-2950. Now, this book, Medical Apartheid, by Harriet Washington, let me say this. I own a copy of the book. And this book is one of the first gifts that I gave to my son-in-law, whose birthday happens to be on the day after Christmas Day. So he gets shortchanged all the time. You know, those people who have a birthday on the day after Christmas Day or the day before, they kind of get, you know, well, they get their birthdays become eclipsed by this other holiday or vice versa. So they don't get two gifts. They tend to get like one and a half. Well, anyway, I have actually given this book to people who matter to me as a gift because it is that important and the history is that compelling, and it is the kind of history you're not going to find anywhere else. This book made history. Harriet Washington made history when she wrote this book, because this a work of this nature had never before been done. There are other books that have that have discussed the issue of medical research, but as is pointed out in the book itself, her approach, the compilation that she has done of the evidence and the experimentation and the history in one place. You can find some of this stuff in different places. You know, if you can go to 60 or 70 different books, you can conceivably come to the same conclusion and get the same information. But here it is in a 500 page volume that is available together with this CD, this audio CD of author Harriet Washington talking with WBAI's Kathy Davis. So here's what we'll do now. We're going to go directly now to an excerpt from that conversation. Let's say a 15-minute, let's say, yes, maybe about 15 minutes or so. But what I'd like you to do is to call while the presentation is in progress. So this is not one of those days when you can wait until the third hour. There is no third hour today. Today, we're here until 5 in our regular time slot. And as you know, we aim, the standard here is that we should be able to raise $4,000 in each of the primetime hours. So primetime here, which is when we're on, we should be able to raise $4,000 in each of the 2 hours. So that, of course, makes for a minimum of $8,000 from between 3 and 5. Generally, I aim for, you know, 10 or more, but, you get a sense of what it is that we have to do. And where did we come up with those figures? Because that's actually, it's a reflection of what it actually takes to run the radio station, to keep the lights on the microphones live. We do not accept corporate or commercial underwriting, which is why we are able to invest this much time and to invest this much detail in this kind of issue. 212-209-2950. Your $125 pledge gets you both the book Medical Apartheid by Harriet Washington and the 70-minute interview between Harriet Washington and Kathy Davis. Or if you're on fixed income, if you're a student, you're on fixed income, we want you to get this before the semester is over. So if you're a student, you need to get this. So we will send it to you with your pledge. We'll send you the audio CD of the interview with your pledge at the $35 level. So if you're on fixed income, then you're a senior, you're a student, whatever, you know, just give us a call, make a pledge at the $35 level, and we'll send it to you. Because the important thing is to get the information into your hands. It doesn't do us any good sitting here. These books don't do me any good sitting here. I already have it. And I want you to have it. The interview doesn't do us any good sitting here. We want to air it. I'm going to air an excerpt from it in a moment, and we want you to have it because it will bear repeated visits. 212-209-2950. How do you pledge? You can use your Visa, American Express, or MasterCard. You can honor your pledge with a personal check or money order. You can use the electronic funds transfer system or the installment plan. But please begin calling right now, 212-209-2950. I have a series of reviews here, reviews of Harriet Washington's book. I wanted to share excerpts with you. I may not be able to do that. There was one review by Alondra Nelson in the Washington Post I wanted to share, and there's another one by Amaya Rivera from Mother Jones magazine. Both of these are very eloquent reviews of the book, and there are a number of others I have here. As you know, I over-prepare for the program. My theory here being, as you know, we take calls from listeners when we do our regular program. So my theory is that if I walk in here on any day and the telephones are not working, I should be able to hold your interest. I should be able to sustain your interest with a compelling 2-hour program, even if I am unable to reach any guests or if we are unable to field any calls. So that's just the standard that I set for myself. It's what I do. It's what we do here on TalkBack. So Michael G. Haskins and I are looking forward to your support this afternoon, your overwhelming support. We're looking for a tsunami of telephone calls. We'd like you to join those who are on the line right now. But so please call while the presentation is in progress. Here now, an excerpt from that conversation, an interview with Harriet Washington, the author of the book Medical Apartheid, The Dark History of Medical Experimentation on Black Americans from Colonial Times to the Present. She is interviewed by WBAI's Kathy Davis.
Medical Apartheid. It has such a breadth in terms of where it starts. It starts with slavery. I think that all of us knew about some of the horrors that took place during that time, but this is a revelation to me. I didn't understand quite how bad it might be, and it kind of actually reminded me of Nazi Germany and the experimentation that was done during the Holocaust. And well, here in America, African American people have experienced our own Holocaust, and in many ways it still seems to be going on.
Yes, unfortunately. We have a limited success story in that African Americans are no longer nakedly vulnerable in the way they were during slavery. In slavery, our vulnerability extended to the social sphere, the legal sphere. One historian, Todd Savitt, describes slaves as being legally invisible. Today, things are very different. We have protections. They're certainly far from perfect, but they exist. And we have people who are able to bring problematic research to light. So we're in a much better situation today, but we can't afford to drop our vigilance. The dangers do persist. And as you pointed out, it began in slavery. Enslavement was the fortunately fertile ground upon which all these abuses proliferated. And they proliferated wildly during enslavement. And it's only because, as Churchill says, history is written by the victors, that we don't know more. We haven't known more until now into what actually transpired during slavery and how important the exploitation and abuse of slaves was to American medicine, the development of American medicine.
So let's go into that. There was one thing that I read in your book that was just horrifying, and it was talking about the development of gynecology and the kind of horrific experiments that took place with women, and with one particular physician.
James Marion Sims, the father of American gynecology, by the way. Dr. Sims epitomizes so much of what was true about the tortured relationship of black people to American medicine. He was not unique in working with slave women. All important gynecological procedures that were painful or that during this Victorian era were shameful, degrading, they were all tested and perfected on black women by an assortment of surgeons. Everything from cesarean sections to ovarectomies, the removal of ovaries because of disease or because the physician was or researcher was just curious, to all these procedures were done on enslaved women because during the Victorian era, you simply didn't look under the skirts of white women. Even if you were a physician, you were not permitted to do that. And also, white women were certainly not going to submit to such treatment. It was painful. It was degrading. But slaves couldn't say no. And Sims, knowing that, he did a lot of troubled experiments, but he had a pool of black women who he kept. They were enslaved, and he kept them in what he later liked to call a hospital, but it was actually a laboratory. And he perfected the repair of vesicovaginal fistula. This was a rupture very common in the antebellum South, and it was very common among white women, but much more common among slave women, because one of the things that predisposed a woman to having this horrible complication of childbirth was poor nutrition. Slaves were very poorly nourished. They were practically starved. And also youth and the very poor nutrition and the youth of slave mothers, because they typically gave birth 3 years before white women. These two things combined to give them a very small pelvis. And because they were so young, the baby's head couldn't go through easily. So all too often, childbirth and slavery was a very risky affair. And if the mother survived, she was often left with this fistula, which created an opening, torn openings that eroded away between her vagina and her anus. And basically, she was incontinent. Urine and feces would go through all three apertures, creating infection, pain. It was a horrible situation. This condition made many white Southern women invalids for life. And for black women, it made them useless in the fields. They could no longer work. So everyone wanted a cure for this. And when Sims decided he was going to achieve medical glory by the cure, he turned naturally to slave women who couldn't refuse. He used, without anesthesia, which was available to him, he repeatedly cut their vaginas, tried to sew the opening together, but saw it reopen every time. This went on for 5 years. One woman, Anarka, had 30 surgeries. Horribly painful, horribly distressing. In the end, he was able to close some of her fistula, and he immediately became the toast of American medicine, the father of American gynecology. He went to Second Empire of France. He went to on to become the first president of the American Medical Association, went to the New York Academy of Medicine right on 103rd and 5th Avenue, and he became famous. And he became famous because of the work he had done. But interestingly, in later years, when he discussed the work, he never characterized them as slave women. In some of the illustrations, we see illustrations of white women. Yes. He'll show the diagram. He'll show how he did the surgery, and there'll be a picture of a white woman accompanying it. So this was also a very common trend when abusive research was done. A little bit later in the century, physicians tended to hide it. They tended to deny that these were slaves, whereas in the beginning, of course, the medical journals and physicians were very open about the fact that, of course, we use slave women. Dr. Sims, because he had two faces, you know, the face he turned to white women was the hero who cured this main cause of invalidism, you know, the father of American gynecology, president of the American Medical Association. And that's how he's remembered. If you go to Central Park and see a statue across from the Academy of Medicine, he's revered as a hero. But the hidden part of this history, the other face, the other Janus face of medicine, is the abuse of slaves, without which he could never have achieved fame and glory, and without which he couldn't have made this medical advance.
During this time period, there was enormous, enormous abuse of African American people, slave people at that time. And you spoke of how they displayed people's bodies. And it kind of reminds me of this exhibit we have now at the South Street Seaport, where they have all these Chinese people frozen.
Yes, yes.
And I actually find that to be kind of a horrific thing even there. So I'm wondering if you could talk about some of these other disrespectful abuses that black people had to endure.
Certainly. I think that's very important. I want to say a word just before I get into that, though, about scientific racism. I think it's very important to remember that scientific racism, which gave the philosophical basis for this abuse, which excused it and made it all right to abuse and experiment on black people, during that time, it was considered just science. In retrospect, we can see that that's nakedly racist. And also, it's not logical. It's not scientific, you know. But to them, it was just science. And if you questioned it, you were questioning science. And of course, there weren't many black people around to question it.
Well, I guess you're right. That brings out the sad truth that during this time, black people were not really considered human beings. So they must have looked at it the same as if we see scientists now experimenting on monkeys and cats and dogs and rabbits, and mm-hmm. they treated us in that same category.
That's right. And even more insidiously, what physicians did was physicians supported the slavery system by coming up with medical theories. If you, like a white slave owner, had horrendous heat, a very damp environment, huge fields to plow, someone who had to work in these very sweaty, hot conditions, malaria that lurked to make them ill, what better godsend than to have a scientist say to you, you need to use black people, Africans, because they don't get malaria. They don't become ill in the heat. They will work long hours and really not feel pain the way we feel pain. You know, so all these tenets of scientific racism were very politically expedient for physicians, because all these things also justified experimentation, and for the slavery system. So there was a method to their madness, so to speak. It was intentional.
So they used science really to justify slavery
exactly.
in the first place.
Exactly. And I think many of us have a mindset, we're encouraged to have a mindset, where you don't question science, where science is considered something that is pure and not tainted by, you know, tawdry political and social and personal considerations. But that's not true. Science is another human endeavor like any other. And during that period, science quite readily prostituted itself in order to maintain slavery and with it our nation's profitable way of life. And part of that was portraying black people as perfect experimental subjects, as well as perfect laborers in the fields.
So how widespread was this experimentation on African people?
It was very prevalent. And the interesting thing is that although there were not the organizations we have now to collect data, you know, there was no American Medical Association. There were very few medical associations of any kind. Medical schools were basically proprietary, owned by doctors and not affiliated with other universities. So getting hard data is not easy. But fortunately, there are historians who had done a very able job of collecting hard data. And for people who owned a good number of slaves, experimentation medication was actually the norm. Physicians in the South particularly frequently bought slaves in order to experiment on them. But it wasn't only relegated to the North. Thomas Jefferson experimented on his slaves, gave over 200 slaves some dubious vaccines before he gave them to his own family to make sure that they were safe. In Boston, Zabdiel Boylston used 243 slaves and his own son to test a smallpox treatment. So it was very prevalent. Slaves who were just there to work in the fields were often lent to a physician. The case of John Brown that I describe in the book, that was a slave who whose master had been cured of a disease by a doctor and was so grateful. He said to the doctor, "Is there anything that I can do for you? What do you want?" He said, "Let me have one of your slaves." And he lent him the slave who, after working in the fields all day, was then subjected to horrible experiments, being made to sit in a hot hole until he fainted, to test a sunstroke remedy, have his skin lanced so that the doctor could see how far the black skin went and see whether there's any evidence in the internal part of the fascia, whether there's any evidence of being black. They were always looking for clues of someone that was black that didn't depend on skin color. Because as they continued raping black women and breeding with black women, slaves were becoming lighter and lighter skinned. And this was a frightening thing for them, because if there were too many pale, slaves walking about, then that actually was threatening the social order. Mm-hmm. And I think that comes to your earlier question, too, about display. You know, the display of slaves, display of black people was very important, because it was another tenet of scientific racism that a black person could always be, quote unquote, discovered. There were people, today we think of skin color, hair texture as things that give us clues to race. In that time, though, these were true, but they saw that black people were gradually becoming lighter skinned. The original black people who were kidnapped from West Africa were very dark skinned and just very easily discernible from a white person. But as time went on, there were more and more lighter skinned black people with what we think of as a Caucasian texture to their hair, more and more frequently, and they became desperate to find other ways of certifying that people were black. And, it's interesting because America, having been settled by rebels and criminals in large part, they were very desperate to maintain their white identity. Europe is sort of looking down on them, thinking of them as a nation of sort of pretenders to white status. You don't really qualify as white, And so it was a big threat to them. So these displays are very important because these displays were propagandistic in a scientific sense. They would display black people and manipulate the displays in order to emphasize the bestial nature of black people. It was like a human zoo. Here are all these displays to prove that they're not white people. And it was first done by physicians who, if they found a slave who had an anomalous body, a hermaphrodite. Well, there are white hermaphrodites too, but they always found in an anomalous black body some clue to their bestial origin. So a black person who, for example, was born with a syndrome that caused low intelligence and short stature, suddenly this is proof. This is proof that these people are more animal than white. And what they would do is they wouldn't just say, here's a boy born on a plantation with low intelligence and this peculiar physiology. They would make up a history for him. Here's someone who was found wandering the coast of Africa. He comes from a whole tribe of people who cannot speak. He comes from a whole tribe of people who can't walk, but, they actually move like turtles on the ground. There was always a parallel to an animal. And they drew these parallels between Africans of short stature and monkeys. They were constantly displaying skeletons of small monkeys and skeletons of small Africans and drawing attention to all these parallels. And as things escalated, it became more and more popular. P.T. Barnum actually exhibited a great number of slaves and black people. He would do things like take a normal person of normal intelligence, clothe him in, implant horns on his head, clothe him in, leopard skins and say, again, here's an African that I found who can't speak and has feet like a monkey. It was just very, very absurd, even in New York City. And even in New York City in the 20th century, an African was displayed in the Bronx Zoo, Oda Benga. And he was put in the Bronx Zoo. His cage mate was an orangutan. His cage was littered with bones. The exact same kind of propagandistic display, because the message is, At that time, people were still contesting Darwin's theory of evolution. So he was a sort of plebeian argument, you know, for evolution. Here's an example of a man who's at the boundaries between being an animal and a human. You know, he's not quite human, he's not quite an animal, and by extension, this applied to all black people. So these displays were very important, and it's interesting because there have been people who have said, well, why is this in the book about research with African American? It's not really research, but it is research, because these were promulgated by physicians, and they bolstered scientific theories. And without a lot of the shaping of public consciousness about black people that was caused by these theater-like displays in the medical context, I think it would have been harder to sell other theories of inferiority.
Author Harriet Washington, that's just a taste. And that's just a taste from the beginning of the conversation, just the beginning of the interview. It gets worse or better depending on your perspective on the matter, meaning that the revelations become increasingly horrific and bizarre. And this is the result of her extensive research. Harriet Washington, who's been a fellow in ethics at Harvard Medical School, a fellow at the Harvard School of Public Health, senior research scholar at the National Center for Bioethics at Tuskegee University, journalist and editor. Her writings have appeared just about everywhere, USA Today and other publications. She's been a Knight Fellow at Stanford University, written for such academic forums as the Harvard Public Health Review and the New England Journal of Medicine, and is the recipient of numerous prestigious awards for her work. She is author of the book Medical Apartheid, The Dark History of Medical Experimentation on Black Americans from Colonial Times to the Present. I decided this afternoon that we were going to share this with you in view of the recent revelation regarding the Guatemala syphilis experiment and the fact that that Dr. Cutler, who headed that experiment, also headed the Tuskegee experiment. And the Tuskegee story, by the way, is coming up in this interview. Now, 3 minutes before the top of the hour, and I need 30 calls right now. I need 30 calls, 212-209-2950, because I'd like to bring you more of this. I am Hugh Hamilton with Michael G. Haskins. We'd like to bring you more of this interview. Harriet Washington talking with WBAI's Kathy Davis. It is now 2 minutes before the top of the hour. We are well short of where we ought to be at this point, but I'm not going to panic because I know I invested an enormous, I front loaded quite a bit of information on this program this afternoon, taking quite a bit of time to set up the context and the parameters of what it is that we're going to be doing. And now we'd like you to help us to continue to do this work that we're doing by calling 212-209-2950. The interview as a standalone item on an audio CD is available with your pledge at the $35 level. We'll get you the book and the interview together with your pledge at the $125 level. It's a 500-page book, and believe me, it is just the introduction alone is well worth the price of admission. 212-209-2950. So I need 29 additional calls right now. 29 additional calls. This is Talkback. I am Hugh Hamilton with Michael G. Haskins, our audio engineer and director of incidental music. Mr. Haskins, you and I were listening. We've heard this before, and yet we were appalled all over again by some of these revelations.
Absolutely, Hugh. Every time it's a new experiment, a new experience, I should say, for us when we hear it, and we hope that you will agree with us as well, and you will support this radio station, this program, Talkback, WBAI, this commercial-free, listener-sponsored radio station, and we're asking you to join us, become members of this radio station, support us at whatever level you can. Now we have 4 calls on the line. We need to have 30 calls before we break, and we hope that we can do that straight away. We're asking for you, wherever you are, if you are listening to us, to take this time and join us now. We have some volunteers standing by. The number to call is 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. The interview by itself, the interview with Kathy Davis and Harriet A. Washington, is for a pledge of $35. If you're just interested in the audio that we just played some excerpt
Thank
from,
you. Thank
we
you.
Will send that to you, $35. If you're interested in the book CD pack, and you should get this book, Medical Apartheid, The Dark History of Medical Experimentation on Black Americans from Colonial Times to the Present by Harriet A. Washington,
Thank
is
you.
Yours
Thank
for
you.
A pledge of $125. We're well on our way to getting those 30 calls. 212-209-2950. We said just a moment ago that we hope that we would have to get a Brinks truck in here to get all of the funds, all of mm-hmm. your support for this program this afternoon. Did you see the masterful way that Hugh set this up? You cannot get this information and this presentation anywhere, I'm telling you, anywhere else on your radio dial. And we're asking you to support us now. Support Talk Back with Hugh Hamilton, 212-209-2950. You can pledge using your Visa card, your MasterCard, or American Express, but we need you to make that call. We come to you often, but that's because we only have you for our support. So make your calls now. Volunteers standing by. Be patient as we get to your calls. 212-209-2950.
That's right. Thank you very much, Michael G. Haskins. Thank you very much to you and you and